All right, we're back on the 1:30 docket, and we're going to finish the docket up. I understand that council may be en route to argue for the appellee. That may or may not be the case, but in any event, we're going to go ahead and allow the appellant to make argument on the case, so you may begin.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. Mark Honhart of Gregory R. Giamatti and Associates, appearing on behalf of Defendant Maria Wilcox in this matter. May it please the court. Ms. Wilcox is appealing the trial court's judgment in this case based upon three errors of law. The first being the instructions the court gave to the jury, specifically with respect to a negligence per se instruction, or a jury instruction based upon a negligence per se, after the court had twice ruled that there would be no negligence per se instruction at all based upon Colorado statutes, because the evidence didn't simply support the giving of such an instruction. The court acted contrary to its own law, the case in this matter, and then with respect to the specific instruction the court gave, the negligence per se instruction created a conflicting and confusing set of instructions for the jury to consider, and if the jury had been correctly instructed, would likely have come to a different decision in the case.
The second point is your strict liability argument on prong two of the statute, of the code?
Well, that's actually part of there are two prongs of the same argument. First, with respect to the law of the case, and then second, with respect to the strict liability argument as the ordinance.
That's under prong two of the ordinance.
Correct. Yes, that's correct. I misunderstood.
Mr. Honor, you may be about to jump into this, so I'll apologize if you were. On law of the case, isn't it discretionary? When you're talking about the district court reviewing its own ruling, can't the district court decide, well, I think I got it wrong the first time and change its mind?
Strictly speaking, that's correct, but the court did not do that in this case. The court, when it was reminded that it already made this decision, had simply forgotten that it had made that decision in the first place. And based upon its recollection, without reviewing the record, stated, well, we were never presented with this argument in the first place, so this is the first time that I'm looking at this.
But does it matter if the court, and I agree with you, the court made a mistake, there's no question. But if the court looks at it now in trial number two and says, I think there's evidence to support it, regardless of what the court thought before, can't the court do that under the law of the case doctrine?
Well, that's correct. It is discretionary in an absolute sense. But even in the second trial, the court initially made the same decision of saying there wasn't evidence on the record to support the giving of an instruction. It was only because plaintiffs in the middle of trial, or near the end of trial actually, presented this Denver municipal ordinance that nobody had ever mentioned before, including the investigating officer for the traffic accident itself, and it essentially came out of left field that there was this municipal ordinance that if you view it a certain way, was presented to the court, presented for an instruction to the jury. So the only thing that changed was that a different legal authority was presented.
But isn't that fair? And as I guess, I'm not. You must be arguing abuse of discretion, but I'm not quite sure why it's an abuse of discretion.
Well, it ties into the second prong of the argument that the way this statute, the way this ordinance was presented. Well, in the first instance, as Judge Connolly observes, the first prong of the Denver Revised Municipal Ordinance tracks the language of the state statutes, that the three state statutes that plaintiff had originally presented, almost identically. It's only with the second prong of the statute that creates this strict liability that none of the parties, including the court, really had time to properly argue or present or discuss it, that created the problem. But I would agree with your overall assessment that in an absolute term, the court does have just discretion to revisit the decision. It simply, it didn't go back and make that decision on the record, though. It simply, it made the decision based upon some other perception that had never considered the issue before.
Is your argument, too, apart from the instructional issue, is that getting to the immigration status, or when does that come in?
Well, that would have been my third error. The immigration issue, since you brought that up, has to do with the plaintiff's ability to claim lost income as part of his economic damages in the case. And in this case, plaintiff was claiming lost income, past income, and lost future income. Now, the only purpose for asking about the plaintiff's immigration status was to determine whether a plaintiff could probably make a showing that he could claim lost wages, that he could legally earn a living in the United States. And the fact of the matter is the trial court would not even permit the opportunity to have an evidentiary hearing on the matter, let alone to allow a defendant to conduct any discovery into the issue and present it.
Let me ask that second point. Taken backwards, I understand discovery. You wanted an extension of discovery cutoff so you could ask the questions. Where did the court say you can't have an evidentiary hearing? It just granted a motion to eliminate, didn't it? And did you ask for an evidentiary hearing?
Yes, Your Honor. I don't know if I can get you the precise reference in the record to that, but as part of defendant's motion for an enlargement of time to conduct discovery, one of the paragraphs for relief asked if the court would grant an evidentiary hearing on the matter to consider plaintiff's immigration status just for that purpose and to determine whether it was even an issue. I mean, it is conceivable that the evidence would show that he was here, that plaintiff was here legally and could earn a living, and that would probably have been the end of the matter.
Did you ever try to make an offer of proof that you would have shown that he was here illegally, or?
We did, no. That offer of proof was not made. The order was made on the written motions, and there was no oral argument on the issue.
Mr. Hunter, isn't one of the problems here a timing problem? The court refused to extend the discovery, but the court didn't deny discovery into the matter. It appears as though that could have been an interrogatory or a request to produce documents that probe that issue.
Well that really relates back to the second issue for appeal, because this is information that plaintiff had a duty to disclose in the first place, and it goes also to the issue of his injury financing relationship with plaintiff's counsel and medical providers. And that is Rule 26A1 and 26E the Todd v. Bear Village cases make it clear that the plaintiff has an obligation to disclose this information in advance of trial, not make defendants go out and go searching for this kinds of information.
I suppose his position might be, well, that's not settled in Colorado. It's not relevant to any matter in dispute. And whether or not I'm here on a visa or I'm not here on a visa has nothing to do with the fact that your client ran into me.
That's true with respect to the immigration issue, but it's not true with respect to plaintiff's claim damages and initial disclosures. The computation of damages, this goes back to the second argument, that plaintiff was claiming as damages in this lawsuit and his 26A1 disclosures that he owed interest on unpaid medical bills without disclosing the fact that there was this injury financing organization out there, never supplementing, never correcting the record, never correcting or supplementing the disclosures in the case. So the timing issue is certainly a significant point, but plaintiff actually raised this issue himself in the combined motion in limine that was filed after the close of discovery. Plaintiff filed this combined motion in limine to preclude any reference to plaintiff's immigration status or some of these financial arrangements. And that was basically the alert that defendant received in this matter, that there were these issues out there.
I take it that was in response to the deposition testimony where Mr. Silva said he was here from Mexico, that he'd come here from Texas, and that he didn't have a Colorado driver's license.
I expect that that's the case, although it's not specifically stated, but yes, I believe that's a fair inference.
Mr. Heinhardt, with respect to this, you just said in their original disclosures from the plaintiff, they asked for interest on unpaid bills, which were, I guess, from your view, presumably would include the loans. The other side in their brief said they didn't. And there's a lot of that in these briefs, I have to say. You say one thing, it says completely the opposite. At trial, was there any evidence or any argument by which the plaintiff asked for interest on unpaid bills or loans, or put on any evidence of that?
I don't believe there's anywhere in the trial transcript record in which plaintiff asks for that.
So is the only thing that you're relying on the fact that they put it in their original disclosures?
Yes.
Okay. And if I could ask you just for one second to go back on the immigration issue. Did the court rule on the basis of Rule 403? This is another one of those where one of you says yes and the other of you says no, and you know the record is not so great on this, because there certainly strikes me as a real risk of prejudice here to inject in that this is an unauthorized, you know, alien, given the climate we have in this country now. And so I can see an argument under Rule 403. Did the court rule or say anything about Rule 403?
No, I don't believe the court mentioned any rule or anything else. I'm not sure if I can point to it in the record. My sense is that the judge felt it was a political issue and one that he didn't want to wade into. But I'm not 100% sure that that's in the record.
All right, I appreciate that. I appreciate your candor about that. On the motion in limine, I apologize, I don't have it in front of me. Did the plaintiff move on the basis of Rule 403?
I don't believe the plaintiff had any recitation of legal authority for excluding it, like for Rule 403.
Okay, thank you.
And reserve the rest of my time.
Well, I don't think you're going to have to rebut much of anything, Mr. Honor. So if you'd like to take the rest of your time, you can.
Well, let me ask you, you've got some time here. With respect to the auto injury financing issue, I guess I'm not, is the sole basis for relevance this the fact that they were seeking interest, if they were? Is that your argument for relevance?
No, Your Honor. It's actually a sort of a triangle of interest here. The auto injury financing company shared an office space with plaintiff's counsel. That relationship or that office sharing ended some less than a year, some months before trial started, but certainly after they had been representing plaintiff. So there's one issue involved in that. The other issue has...
What is the issue? Just sliming the plaintiff's lawyer? I'm not tracking with you what the issue is.
It's no intention to do that.
I was being facetious, and I apologize.
The inference that in the vacuum of not having all of the information about what was going on there was an injury financing company. There were a set of doctors or medical providers that they were referring plaintiff to, and there was plaintiff's counsel, and the defendant was simply not able to explore the relationship to those. Number one, there was a real party and interest issue. If the injury finance company had taken an assignment from the plaintiff and for the damages that he was claiming. The second has to do with if the injury financing company is referring to certain doctors and they have a certain relationship there, Is there a bias, and is there an inherent bias of the medical providers to provide certain testimony or provide certain support for plaintiff's claims? And
when did you first learn about the, I don't know if you were the trial lawyer, I don't remember, but when did you first learn about the possibility of this auto financing, auto injury, whatever it is?
Just for the record, I was not a trial attorney on this case. It was discovered in, again, near the time of the motions in limine when they were filed, and I can surmise because of the evidence on the record that information became known to us through another attorney's office that had encountered a similar issue because of the I think it's Exhibit E, and I'm sorry, but I cannot cite to the specific point in the record that lays out the kind of actions that had gone on before involving these entities.
Thank you, Mr. Honor. Thanks for your argument, sir. The matter is deemed submitted, and you can expect a written opinion to issue in due course.
Yeah.
Pinpoint timing. Well, the matter is not deemed submitted. Mr. Schneider, is it?
That's correct.
Mr. Schneider, Mr. Honnard has made his argument, and if you care to make your argument as appellee at this time, you may go ahead.
Thank you.
Certainly.
Thank you.
And I want you to understand that our procedure is, if you're not here, we take counsel's argument who is here. It doesn't mean that you're defaulted in any respect. It simply means that your argument would otherwise have been submitted on the brief.
Thank you, Your Honor.
But since you're here, we'll go ahead and listen to what you have to say.
Thank you, Your Honor. There were three basic issues that were presented to the court on motion. The first one that I wish to talk about is the negligence per se issue, Your Honor. There was a great deal of evidence that was mentioned in the motions regarding the negligence per se, a lot of it dealing with the testimony that was elicited through the trial. Be that as it may, the law is, as was cited, that the negligence per se instructions are not to be, the trial court's decision, pardon me, is on a jury instruction will not be overturned absent an abuse of discretion. Now here, the trial court at the conclusion of evidence decided that there was evidence to support the ordinance that was put forth to the jury.
Can you tell me why prong two of that ordinance is not a strict liability standard? You're finding negligence simply by losing control of a vehicle. Isn't that strict liability?
Well, Your Honor, I would disagree. And the reason for that is if you were to compare the ordinance to the careless driving statute, for instance, both those standards provide that there has to be some duty on the part of the driver. And here, although it doesn't use the word duty, please don't overhear me. Both of them require that there be some duty on the part of the driver. And under the ordinance, the driver still has to act reasonably so as not to lose control of their vehicle.
Where does the ordinance say reasonable? Prong two. It says so as to lose control, and the instruction, I think, quoted prong two. It can either be number one or number two. And number two is if you operate a vehicle so as to lose control under the instruction, the jury can find negligence.
And that is an exact reading. And I believe that that by itself, Your Honor, doesn't make strict liability. I think that what that says is if you do not drive reasonably and you lose control of your vehicle when read in totality with the jury instructions, that is the standard that the jury was looking at.
Okay, but let's just look for a moment. I agree, look at totality. Look at instruction 7 for a moment. I don't see reasonably in there in prong 2.
It is not explicitly stated as such. I will agree.
It's implicit. I don't see it anywhere.
Well, if you look at comparing the first prong and the second prong of the two, the first prong, I believe, does provide some standard that had to be applied there.
I'm with you, but it says or, and it says if you violate any of the ordinance, it constitutes negligence.
I agree with you there. I believe I'd be shooting myself in the foot to argue otherwise. But I will say this, The jury also had to determine whether or not there was a sudden emergency in this case. And the jury took that into account when they looked at the evidence that was provided. And if the jury had decided that there was sudden emergency, that would have been an absolute bar to the negligence claim.
Would that apply to both the negligence and the negligence per se?
Absolutely.
Because the way that, as you know, the instruction is kind of the general negligence instruction and the sudden emergency doctrine is in there. Then you have the negligence per se instruction, which says if you violate the statute, it's negligence. So I think you're right, but I want to make sure it's clear that the sudden emergency doctrine applied to either the negligence or negligence per se claim.
I believe absolutely it had to apply to both, because the negligence per se instruction states that if you encounter a sudden and unexpected item. Here was argued throughout in the motions and the testimony, there was perhaps ice or snow on the road, and there was a great deal of emphasis placed by both parties on that information. In fact, in the closing arguments made by the defense, that is perhaps the most obvious thing that they continued to argue was the sudden emergency. In fact, there was a juror question that was submitted on the sudden emergency issue. The jury was questioning that particular issue. Give me some examples of what is a sudden emergency. So they were considering that during their deliberations.
And if I could pick up on what Judge Connolly was asking you, am I interpreting you correctly? When you're looking at prong two of the ordinance, I think you're reading so as to lose control to incorporate some sort of unreasonableness.
Correct.
Where you're reading it in?
Correct, Your Honor. Okay. Correct. Now, there was some testimony given, and there was also some mention in the motions, and I think it's important to bring up here the law of the case doctrine. And the law of the case doctrine is something that, although one can anticipate that the same rules going between one trial and another will be given, the rule does allow for there to be a decision otherwise, given the facts of the case as they're presented at that time.
And I think you understand the argument. I don't want to speak to my colleagues. I think I understand. Could you address the immigration?
Absolutely.
Immigration point. Would it not be relevant if your client was not an authorized resident and not authorized to work in this country? Would it not be appropriate for that to be considered by the jury in evaluating lost future income?
I actually absolutely agree with you. Although in this case, there was evidence submitted to the jury regarding that. One, there was testimony regarding Social Security numbers, and there was testimony about him having one or two Social Security numbers and whether or not that implied that he might be some sort of illegal citizen. There was also evidence regarding that with regard to W-2s and pay stubs and such that were submitted to the jury.
But what's the effect of the court having granted your motion eliminated to preclude evidence of his legal status or illegal status?
Your Honor, currently in the state of Colorado, there doesn't seem to be, as there is nationwide, case law that supports that an illegal citizen cannot bring a wage loss claim or is limited in bringing their wage loss claim. There's some different cases out there. A lot of the cases that were cited by a defendant deal with cases of discrimination and that sort of thing when looked at what the case is actually about. I believe that in this case, the jury was given information that they could have said this gentleman is an illegal citizen, and they could have taken that into account based on the Social Security numbers and different testimony of things.
But they never heard that, and really it's the same question Judge Connolly just asked. You won your motion in limine. I'm not quite sure how you could argue to us that they heard the evidence anyway, even though you won your motion in limine. Your colleagues here, it wasn't this Mr. Honnard, I know, wanted to put on evidence. This person is not authorized to be in the United States or work here. They didn't get to make that argument because of your motion in limine.
Correct.
Shouldn't they have had the opportunity?
I don't believe so. And I believe that specifically under 403B, and that's what I believe the court determined here, that there was going to be bias.
Let me interrupt you for a second. I apologize. We had a discussion with Mr. Honnard that you didn't hear. I asked, did the court rule on 403 grounds, Mr. Hart? And you have a lot of, he says one thing, you said the other, which I assume perfect good faith on both of your part. Did the court rule on the basis of Rule 403? Did you raise that in your motion in limine?
Absolutely.
Where in the record did the court make a ruling on 403 grounds? If you don't have the record in front of you, I know you raced over here. If you could just help me find it, that would be great.
And you're right. I didn't bring the complete transcript with me. That would have been boxes. But when I went through those items most recently, unfortunately, when I review this court's transcripts, they don't give a lot of detail when he gives his rulings with regard to these things.
That's why I asked my question.
So in all honesty, all I can tell you, because I wasn't the one that argued the case, I can tell you that based on the transcript, I don't see that. But I do believe that the issue was raised in plaintiff's motion, and therefore that would have been one of the considerations the court must have considered when deciding this. And really, that would be the basis. There wasn't any case law cited, because as I say, there is no case law for us, either side, to hang their hat on. So the basis would seem to be, as a 403, a bias.
And what was the form of the court's ruling? Did it just stamp grant on your motion, or did it...
Correct.
Was there an order, or is there a hearing?
There was not a hearing. There was just a stamp. The court granted certain pieces. It was a multiple item, and the court granted certain pieces and denied certain pieces.
And I interrupted you, counsel. You were about to say something about Rule 403, and I apologize. I interrupted you.
Correct. And well, we've kind of discussed that, which is when you're talking about someone's status, you have to consider whether or not there's going to be a bias under 403 that would preclude that evidence. And one of the things that's been pretty standard, I think, throughout the course, because there is no case law for the court to hang their hat on, is whether or not in this particular case, under 403, there'd be an adverse bias to the plaintiff. And the court decided, I believe, thusly, that 403 applied, and that would be the reason for that.
Mr. Schneider,
yes, sir.
Bias doesn't trump an element of a claim. The defendant isn't the defendant entitled to defend on the basis of damages. You have to prove damages as part of your case in chief. So regardless of bias, you're taking away a right to confront the evidence.
And I agree with you that each of the elements of damages must be put forth. But here, as I've stated, even though the motion was granted, in this particular trial, the jury did hear information, specifically with regard to the Social Security numbers, by simply hearing the testimony from the plaintiff who speaks broken English, that sort of thing.
But they
the jury
didn't hear
could
any evidence about damages.
Well, there was evidence to support damages with regard to his wage claim, as I
yes,
said.
And the argument was, well, gee, if you're not here legally, you're not entitled to wages in the future. And it wasn't that evidence the jury was absolutely entitled to hear, if true.
Well, I believe the question you're asking is more so a legal question than it is a fact question, because the trial court has to first decide, is there a legal basis for that evidence to come forth? And I believe the court decided, based on the motion in limine, that there was no basis for that. Now, as we've said, there currently in the state of Colorado, there's no guidance by the Court of Appeals or the Supreme Court on that issue, and therefore the court was doing what it deemed was appropriate at the time. So I believe there was evidence put forth on the damages that were allowed at that time, and the court kept that information back under the only guise it could have, which was under 403. There was no legal basis other than that for them to make that decision at that time.
And what's your basis for saying, you said no two or three times, there's no legal basis? Mr. Honhart tells us, and my memory is consistent with what he said, he asked for a hearing on the issue, and the court said no, thank you. One of the things I'm troubled with, to be very honest with you, Mr. Schneider, is I'm concerned with the record we have here. Didn't have an opportunity to argue, here's what we could have shown. And you know, I suppose it's arguable, maybe they weren't even allowed to make an offer of proof on what they could have shown. And again, I want you to respond to it, but I'm skeptical about your argument that they got a chance here just because they got to put on that your guy had two Social Security numbers. They didn't get to say he's an illegal alien who is not permitted to work here. So you please respond to that.
Well, I think, Your Honor, based on the case law that's been cited by the defendant, that if an evidentiary hearing had been put forth and if the court followed the rules as have been followed in other states, that evidence wouldn't even be allowed, that claim would have been severed, as I understand the case law. There are some cases that seem to say, well, unless you can prove how long the person would be here until deportation, but I find that troublesome because at what point do you make that determination of deportation? There's some cases that cite to that.
And what does the record show about his status? What do we know about Mr. Silver?
Well, the evidence that was...
The status, immigration status.
Correct. The evidence that was put forth was simply that he had W-2s that showed he could work here at a Social Security number, and he was eligible for the draft, that he provided a draft card. So therefore, that would show evidence that he was, in fact, here legally.
Well, it's not. It may support an inference.
Correct. I apologize.
We don't know whether... We don't know his immigration status, basically, on this record.
Correct, based
on
the record.
I'm not asking you about what you might know. I'm saying in terms of the record, what could we tell from the record? We just don't know.
That's correct. I mean, what I've told you is what the record shows, which is Social Security numbers, pay stubs, W-2s, and a Social Security card. That's what the record has.
And no valid Colorado driver's license.
Correct. Correct. He had a Mexican driver's license at the time.
And how long was he in Colorado? Do we know at the time, prior to this accident, do we know how long he was in Colorado?
I don't recall if that was put forth as evidence, frankly.
How long had he worked? What was the evidence of his...
He had been working for quite some time.
In Colorado or in the United States? Or?
I know from my reading even this morning of the testimony that it had shown that he had been in Colorado for at least 4 or 5 years prior.
So
because he had
a substantial work history in this country.
Correct.
And an obligation to get a Colorado driver's license within 90 days.
Correct, but that would have been testimony that could have been elicited from either side and was not correct.
Mr. Schneider, if I can ask you a factual question on this auto injury financing piece.
Yes.
It's a strict factual question. Did Mr. Silva seek interest on unpaid expenses or on loans as an element of damages?
That is not my understanding.
All right, and what's your understanding based on? Just your understanding of the record, or
correct? Based on my understanding of the record, the evidence that showed there were bills that were owed. There was no evidence of the actual liens themselves. Of course, that was put forth based on the motion that was filed. He was not seeking interest on those injury finance bills. It's not how
she put on no evidence of
correct.
Trial with that.
Correct.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Schneider.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Hunter, we're going to give you a couple of minutes to rebut.
Thank you. I just want to apologize for my late attendance today. Thank you.
Because you requested that and you didn't have anything to rebut at the time, but you do now, so we'll give you 2 minutes.
Just to clean up one thing that I did indicate that there was the evidentiary hearing was denied in responding to that. In the reply brief at page 14, and this is found in the record, CD volume 2, page 396 to 402, paragraph 16 includes the following, that defendant would propose that the court hold an evidentiary hearing prior to trial to determine plaintiff's status in the United States. And that's where the issue is raised. There was not oral arguments, and we just have the court's order to go on with respect to that matter. I don't have the reference in the record to whether or not there was a 403 specific argument or determination based upon Rule 403, so unfortunately I can't help the court any in that regard.
I appreciate you looking.
With respect to, I just want to return briefly to the sudden emergency jury instruction as it relates to the strict liability instruction. What my comment was with respect to that was that the jury was presented with a situation in which it had one instruction that said if there was a sudden emergency, the defendant's not negligent. On the other hand, it had the strict liability prong of prong two of the Denver Municipal Code section that said if she lost control, she was negligent. So that's where the instruction became confusing and would have led to jury confusion on the matter.
Well, what do you make of the fact that, as I understand it, the negligence here really is a shorthand for duty and breach, I think, because both instructions then go on to talk about causation, et cetera. Do you agree with that?
Yes, with respect, if you're saying that it goes, that they still have to prove causation and damages, I agree with that.
For both, even for negligence per se?
Correct, yes.
Okay. And do you make, what do we do with the fact that there was a special interrogatory here and the jury found negligence? Does that render this whole issue kind of harmless?
Well, I don't know, because the jury could have certainly been looking at the strict liability prong that says she is negligent, defendant is negligent, irrespective of the sudden emergency finding. We don't know what they found on the sudden emergency.
But they, well, okay. You do agree that the sudden emergency applied to both negligence and negligence per se?
It should, yes.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Honar. Thanks to both counsel. The matter is deemed submitted, and you can expect a written opinion to issue in due course.